plate a potential nugget.
And just picking up on the thing you just said, James, you also say that progress is often exponential and not linear. And in a similar note, you talk about the notion of plateau of latent potential. Could you talk about these two themes in the context of how people think about habits and also the kind of feedback loops they set for themselves as they're building the habits?
Yeah, good question. So let's talk about the idea of compounding and exponential progress first. So I like to refer to habits as the compound interest of self-improvement. And what I mean is that the same way that money multiplies through compound interest, the effects of your habits multiply as you repeat them across time. And the challenging part of any compounding process is that the greatest returns are delayed. And so on day one or day 10 or day 30, you don't really have very much to show for your effort. The curve only takes off down the line once you hit that hockey stick portion, once it really takes off. And this is exactly what it feels like to build a new habit. You know, like, what is the difference on day one of eating a salad for lunch or eating a burger and fries? Not a whole lot. You know, like, your body looks the same in the mirror at the end of the night. The scale hasn't really changed. You don't really have anything to show for the effort that you're putting in. It's only 2 or 5 or 10 years later that you turn around and it's like, wow, those daily habits really do add up. And so in that way, building habits is kind of like this exponential curve. We think, oh, I'll put a little bit of work in and I'll get a little bit of results. So if I put a lot of work in, then I'll get a lot of results. But really, it's much more about time and letting it work for you. And just getting 1% better each day can count for something very significant in the long run. And so this is why I like to say, if you have good habits make time your ally. All you need is for time to work for you, for to let another day move by, and you continue to be put in a better and better position. But bad habits make time your enemy. Every day that clicks by, you're putting yourself a little bit further behind the eight ball. You're digging the hole a little bit deeper. And so for all of those reasons, I think habits are what we could say the compound interest of self-improvement. Now, the next step of this is what you're mentioning with the plateau of latent potential. And the basic idea here is this challenge that I just mentioned where the returns are delayed. You show up and you're not seeing the results that you want. And I like to summarize this by telling a brief little story, which is imagine that you walk into a room. It's cold. You can see your breath. Ice cube is sitting on the table. And you start to heat the room up slowly. You know, you're going to say, do you want to use Fahrenheit or Celsius? What would your audience get better?
Celsius is better.
Okay. All right. So let's say we're heating up this ice cube, right? And it's, I don't know, -5 degrees, something like that. You're heating it up, -4, -3, -2, -1. And the ice cube's still sitting there. You can still see your breath. But then you go from -1 to 0, and it's a 1 degree shift, just like all those that came before it. But suddenly the ice cube melts. You hit this phase transition. And the process of improving is very much like that. The process of building better habits and getting results is very much like the process of heating up an ice cube. And you hear people say things like this all the time. They'll say, like, I've been running for a month, but I can't see a change in my body, you know? And my argument is, running for a month and complaining about not seeing the results you want, or writing your book for 8 months and not having it be finished yet, it's kind of like complaining about heating an ice cube from -5 to -1 degrees and they're not melting. You know, like, the work was not being wasted. It's just being stored. And so you can view each iteration of your habit as building up this potential energy that can then be released later on. And I think about, there's this quote from the San Antonio Spurs NBA basketball teams. They've won 5 championships and they have this quote hanging in their locker room. And it says something to the effect of, when I feel like giving up, I think about the stone cutter who takes his hammer and bangs on the stone 100 times without it showing a crack. And then on the 101st blow, it splits in two. And I know that it wasn't the 101st that did it, but all those that came before. And that is true for pretty much any habit, right? Like, it's not the final sentence that writes the book. It's all those that came before. It's not the latest workout that gets your body fit. It's all those that came before. And so the willingness to accept that 1% improvements make a meaningful difference, even if they don't show you anything on a given day, and then remaining committed to that in the long run. That, I think, is how you capture the power of compounding habits and of letting 1% improvements work for you rather than against you.
Got it. And if I may reconcile this with the point about working hard on the things that come easy and looking for where you're seeing success and really doubling down on it. At some level, I see a little bit of a paradox here, right? Where here you need to chip away at something and suddenly, you know, there's a phase transition where you see the outcomes. With that sort of a delay in knowing where you're seeing outcomes, how do you sort of relay that to the context of where you're trying to build habits? Do you see a little bit of a complexity there that we need to navigate through?
There's definitely a challenge with the speed at which you get feedback. So the faster you can get feedback, the more likely you are to stick to it. And actually, we could rephrase feedback a little bit to say the faster that you get signals of progress, the more that you get signals of progress, the more motivated you're going to feel to stick with it. If you don't have signals of progress, then it feels like you're just kind of stuck in this valley of death and spinning your wheels. And so there are a couple ways to overcome this. The first thing, and I have a chapter in the book where I talk about measurement and both the pros and cons of it, and how it can kind of work for you. But the first thing is you want to choose a measurement that delivers feedback at the right pace. Because if you get feedback too quickly, it's just kind of noise and you're like overreacting to everything. If you get feedback too slowly, then it takes too long and we run into the problem that you just mentioned, which is, well, you say you need to stick with it, but how do I know if this is actually working for me? How do I know if this is something that I'm, you know, inclined to be good at?
Yeah.
And so you can imagine, for example, let's take a workout. If you only measure the number on the scale, well, then that might actually be too slow because you might not actually change weight in any meaningful way until like over a 2-week span or something. If you measure, say, your blood glucose levels, that might be too fast, or your heart rate or your blood pressure, because it might change very rapidly during the workout. But if you do something like tracking your workout, like just put an X on the calendar each day that you swim or go for a run or lift weights, well, that like is feedback at the right pace, which is I showed up and I did the workout today. And so I can feel good about that. And seeing another X on the calendar is like a signal of progress that I'm building up this chain of habits, this chain of workouts. And so I'm not waiting too long and I'm not overreacting to something too short. But figuring out that measurement, that right pace, it might take a little bit of experimentation depending on the habit you're working on. But the point that you bring up is a really good one, which is we do face this challenge where in many fields, pretty much any field, persistence and reliability and consistency will get you better results. But along the way, you really need some signals of progress so that you can be sure that you're on the right path and not just repeating something that isn't going to pay off in the long run.
How we think about setting up feedback loops during transition is a personal passion project of mine. Because when people are in transition, not only are they at the foothills of a compounding curve, they're also in a phase of identity vacuum, and they're keen to cling on to the first straw that comes their way. Professor Herminia Ibarra of London Business School, one of the leading thinkers in the space of transitions, speak about the notion of liminality, where she says that there's a phase where you're neither here nor there, and we need to be comfortable with trying a few things and letting it play out over a period of time before we pick something. She says that leaders often make a mistake of foreclosure or settling too soon for an option.
And so the two principles are, as you said, divergent exploration and delayed commitment. Divergent explorations is, what I mean by that is, whenever I teach people who are in transitions, one of the first things I do is I say, write a list of your possible selves. They don't have to be feasible, they don't have to be public, they don't have to be something you're committing to do, but just let your imagination run wild. What's the set of possibilities? Do a kind of brainstorming with yourself. Don't be embarrassed to write, even if it's ridiculous, put it in there. And it's really interesting what people come up with. It's quite, in fact, we are very multiple and often quite divergent. Doesn't mean you're going to do all of those things, and certainly not at the same time. But when you get permission to be divergent, there's a lot there. And in fact, one of the things that is hard for people in transition is they feel that they must not be ready because they're considering such a different array of options. And they feel that somehow that's wrong, that they are equally passionate and excited about two things that seem mutually exclusive, like getting promoted at my current firm and then starting up a business on something completely different. And one day you're excited about this and the other day you're excited about that and you think you're out of your mind. But in fact, what we're doing is trying to explore and compare and contrast and how do I feel here and how did I feel there? And so when you give yourself, and that's why it takes time, that's why the time factor plays in, to explore more divergently and say, this is actually natural. And it gives me more information so that then I can make the right choice. You make better decisions and you're less likely to do the other thing, the foreclosure, which is take the first thing that comes your way because it's been 6 months and I can't tell people anymore that I'm still, you know, out of work. So the delayed commitment comes from understanding that it's going to take time and you're not going to go for the first thing that comes up or the second thing until you really had a chance to test. Because once you jump, you're going to be stuck there at least another 2 years. And so why not take a little longer at the beginning in order to make a more robust choice?
As we think about compounding curves and latent potential, especially during transitions, it's critical that we don't measure the wrong thing too soon and look for outcomes which might take a longer period of time. A related point actually came up in my conversation with the stand-up comedian Papa CJ, who had an MBA from Oxford and was working as a management consultant. He speaks about his challenges in his early years of stand-up.
You know, I was I was the hardest working comedian in the UK. And normally there's 500 comedians competing for the same gig. I was the kind of guy who would go anywhere, anytime for no money. And a lot of the shows were outside London. So, for example, I would leave London at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, drive to some city in the UK with a bunch of other comedians, do a show there. I was nervous, I wouldn't eat, probably couldn't afford food at that point. Drive back, get dropped off in the outskirts of London at 2 o'clock in the morning. I would pay the driver my share of petrol. I mean, keeping in mind, I wasn't getting paid for any of these shows. I would change 3 different buses to get back home and get home at about 4 o'clock in the morning. I did this every single day for an entire year. But at the end of that year, you have no money, no friends, no relationships, and no life. But every single comedy promoter in the country knows your name. That's where you start from.
In these situations, there's something to be said about measuring balance sheet metrics rather than P&L metrics. To take CJ's example, while he didn't have meaningful cash flows from the business in the first year, he had an asset of relationships with the ecosystem that he could build on and move forward. Thank you for listening. For more, please visit playtopotential.com. If you're deriving value from the content and want to show your gratitude to the podcast, I request you to pay it forward by contributing to an organization that I'm supporting, Antarang Foundation. It helps thousands of children from challenging backgrounds play to the unique potential. Please visit the Pay It Forward section at playtopotential.com to know more.